There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is a game director who has pioneered new forms of non-linear storytelling that blend film and games. After a 12-year stint at the British development studio Climax, where he directed Silent Hill: Shattered Memories, he began work on an independent project, Her Story. In the game, which was partly inspired by Sharon Stone's audition tapes for the film Basic Instinct, you sift through a trove of police interview footage to uncover a mystery. Her Story's style of disconnected, live-action sleuthing has become characteristic of my guest's work, which includes the games Telling Lies and, most recently, the Netflix-published Immortality, a game described by Prospect magazine as a culture-spanning psychovisual experiment. "All my games have been about identity," he says. "It's scary that the people we've known for decades are unknowable to us." Welcome, Sam Barlow.
Wow, that was quite an intro. That made me sound very exciting.
You are very exciting. Yeah, well, I'm hoping we can get to know you a little bit through this conversation, at least. I think the last time I spoke to you was shortly after Her Story came out, and you told me that you spent some of your childhood growing up in Tanzania, is that correct?
That is correct, yeah, from the age of five for a couple of years.
What took you out there?
Yeah, so my dad was a civil engineer, so like for most of my childhood, he wasn't senior enough, so if there was a road being built, he would like move to where the road was. And then in this case, they were building a road around a mountain, I believe. Obviously, as a five-year-old, I wasn't completely plugged in. But building a road around a mountain out in the middle of Tanzania. We always said, because to me, looking back and like being very self-analytical, you know, taking me out of normality and everything that, you know, the day-to-day of living in England and how that looked, and plonking me in, you know, the middle of Tanzania for a couple of years was, you know, quite eye-opening. I've got two younger brothers, and I think they were possibly, like, too young to kind of appreciate it. But for me to, well, A, you know, be put into a different culture and see things are different and the geography is different and the weather is different. But also to then come back to England and have missed, to have missed 2 years of like stuff, like all the other kids knew about cars and sports and TV and things. And I think as not to get very pretentious, but like as a storyteller, was kind of useful to come back and have that slight sense of being kind of outside of things, looking in.
Did you feel that you sort of had some secret knowledge or something? I remember in the film Mean Girls, this is a strange reference, but Lindsay Lohan's character, she turns up at school after growing up in Africa, doesn't she? And she sort of has just this other experience to the, or perspective to the other children because of what she's seen. Did you feel like that, like a slight outsider?
Yeah, for sure. No, I've always felt a strong connection to Lindsay Lohan. you know, across all of her work, I'm very pleased to see that she's returning.
And did video games feature in your young childhood at all?
Yeah, like, I mean, I think, you know, sometimes people will ask me, especially as I do this stuff that is more kind of film and TV adjacent, like, oh, why do you choose to make video games, right, rather than go off and just make a movie or whatever? And part of my explanation is usually, well, video games were always there. When we returned from Tanzania, I went to this tiny village school and the head teacher was very strange and somewhat obsessed with D.H. Lawrence. As kids, we had no comprehension of who he was. We even had a school trip to D.H. Lawrence's birthplace, which is so random. Like, what were the parents thinking? But he would just like let us go off and play in the woods. Like, it'd be like, today, let's just play in the woods. But also, he would just like sign up to any scheme that was being run, you know, for schools. So we got one of the very first computers in our school, I believe. We had a, you know, it was just this one computer and it sat in the corner. Each kid, you got like, I'm going to say, you know, like an hour or so a week that you got to play on this computer. And I remember they had, the one I remember the most is there was a text game. I've since tried to like track this down and it doesn't seem to exist anymore, though I found a couple of other people who like remember it and it appears in a catalog or something. But and it was set on like a desert island and you were washed ashore on this desert island and the goal of the game was to escape. If I remember correctly, there were multiple ways to do this, and I think it was ostensibly trying to teach kids, you know, certain skills and thinking. But you know, so you would play it for an hour, make very little progress, and then spend the entire rest of the week playing it in your head, like planning what you're going to do next time.
Wow.
So that was definitely, I'm sure if I look, you know, if I analyze these things, that was quite formative. And then after that, my parents bought us the Amstrad CPC home computer. I believe at the time, you know, you had a choice of home computer in the UK. There was the Commodore 64, which was very expensive, and that was kind of the sexy one, had the best music and things. There was the Spectrum, which was the cheaper one, and that was the punk rock home computer. That was all the kind of coolest bedroom coders were on the Spectrum. And then the Amstrad CPC was the most boring. But some of the salesperson had managed to pitch them that this was the most educational of them. I'm not sure how. So we had the Amstrad CPC, which, and you know, so then my story was very similar to a lot of kids who grew up in that world, in that, you know, you had to type in, you know, you type in your own games, or even just like running a video game you bought from the shops, you would have to at least type in like load, blah, 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 blah.
You know? Right, right. The games you typed in, they came from the back of magazines.
Yes, absolutely. Again, that was, living in a small village and being interested in games and then later movies and things, like 90% of what I experienced was stuff that I never even played, right? It was just looking through the magazines, pouring through these magazines, looking at screenshots. But yeah, the magazines would have these type-ins. Even the most casual player of games on like a home computer back then was going to be exposed and have to take on board a certain amount of like, how do these things work? You know, from a kind of formative age, computer games were there and I was playing them. And you know, this was at a point where if you no one identified as a gamer in that way, but like if you were interested in gaming as a hobby, you were playing everything. Like, you know, there were enough games that you could kind of be aware of everything coming out. Even if I had preferences for certain types of games, I would play the racing games and the sports games and the puzzle games. So, you know, when I started as like a teenager to write terrible fiction, and also was mostly like at that time thought I was going to be a painter. That was the dream.
Is that because you were getting encouraged in your art classes at school?
I was really into it, and I had a certain talent for drawing and painting. But also, like, obviously, like, again, my parents will kill me, if they were to listen to this. But, you know, there's a certain amount of moving around a lot and, you know, those 2 years in Africa and stuff. To some extent, like my formal academic training was somewhat disrupted by all that. So for a while, people thought that I was not necessarily very academic, but clearly had a gift for drawing and things. So they would kind of encourage me to do that sort of thing. And then after a while, I kind of certainly like in my late teens, realized that I was actually reasonably academic and kind of caught up. And then people were like, oh, don't worry about the painting and the drawing. You could have a job where people pay you money and, you know, you could be a professional.
Can I just cut in? Is this something to do with you not being needing glasses? Is that right?
Oh, wow, you've done some research here. There was something where I had not necessarily had my eyes tested. And at some point, it was like, I don't know, 11 or maybe around 11, they tested my eyes and they're like, oh, crap, like, you need glasses to be able to think and read and pay attention to things. And I was like, oh, really? So, you know, that might also have affected him. So there was definitely an element of, as soon as I was, like, interested in making things and writing stories and doing paintings and stuff, the computer was there as well. So as much as I was writing terrible linear fiction, I was also making text adventures for my friends. And as much as I was like painting and drawing, I was doing pixel art and trying to play around with kind of computer graphics tools.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say it's quite unusual to be dabbling in all of that so young. But then I suppose if you're a creative child, then you just use whatever tools are in front of you, right? And that might be a canvas or it might be a computer or an Amstrad.
Yeah, I mean, at the point where people realized I might be somewhat academic, they'd start describing me as a polymath in my school reports, and I was quite proud of that.
That's a good label. And also that experience that you mentioned of sort of looking through a magazine at the screenshots of games coming out, and you sort of have to imagine what the game played like because you couldn't see it in motion. That's gone, hasn't it? Now, sort of, you know, any child can just hop on YouTube and watch a Let's Play or something and see how it all works. But yeah, there's something to be said, isn't there, for having to fill in those gaps, which again, I think is a bit of a theme of your work.
Yeah, no, definitely. Our version of the internet was getting a magazine like once a month and reading it cover to cover 100 times. You know, like you say, there's probably games I think I've played from that era that I never played. We'll get onto this, I'm sure, but like I was particularly interested in like text adventures. There was a special section within the magazine dedicated to those games, and part of it would be like solutions and tips. The funny one would be a game called Corruption, which I was kind of obsessed with, which again, for like a kid playing it, it was set in the financial world of London. So like the first task of the game was you had to dispose of some cocaine that someone had planted on you. So never having played that game, I'd seen some screenshots, you know, loved the idea of it. And then you're reading, and it, because it was a text game, within the magazine, it would be like, here is the solution. And they would list out, you know, go to toilet cubicle, open system, take cocaine. Even though I hadn't played that game, like I had in my head, you know, played, you know, at least that was, I guess, the equivalent of watching a YouTube walkthrough, right? But again, it was, you know, a lot of emphasis placed on your imagination.
So I've asked you to pick five games to construct your perfect console. I have to say, I hadn't heard of all the games you've picked. Do you want to tell us about the first one?
Yeah, I mean, so the period of kind of gaming history that fascinates me and was super influential was this kind of text adventure. At some point, somebody coined the phrase bookware, which I think stuck slightly. One of the things that I find myself doing a lot in gaming is the memory of the industry is very bad, right? The short-term memory of the industry is quite poor.
Yes.
And so everybody's like, oh, finally, we have these video games that are telling stories, that have proper writing and characters and are tackling themes and subjects, or, you know, have types of gameplay that are very innovative. You know, thinking that all we were playing in the 80s was Pac-Man or whatever. But this particular era, to me, is fascinating because it was a point where the big companies, so the Electronic Arts, the Activisions, everybody was like, hey, video games are this cool new thing. And because of the state of the technology, the synergy that they were seeing then versus, you know, now it's all Hollywood meets video games. Back then, they were like, well, hey, what can this bring to literature? They started bringing in quote unquote real writers to create these things. You know, again, as somebody that has always been interested in storytelling and what the computer can bring to that, I guess fascinating to see, you know, how some of these were successful experiments. Some of them were not. Some of them are very interesting now. And as we'll see, like some of them have been quite influential. So if we go on the order I sent you, which was not necessarily very thought through, but the first one is actually arguably my favorite game of all time.
Really? Okay.
Which I managed to kill dead an IGN reporter. Her story won an award at the South by Southwest Games Festival. And the South by Game Awards were actually quite... I went out there thinking it would be very cool and hip, like kind of South by... But they were very, like, capital G games,
right.
Like lots of bass drops and machine guns and explosions. So it was a very weird atmosphere in which Her Story won. And coming off stage, I was kind of jumped and they were like, "Hey, Sam, you just won this award. That's fantastic. What's your favorite game of all time?" And I said, it would be Steve Moretzky's A Mind Forever Voyaging. And they had, that was it. There was no...
How many guns has it got?
I mean, it does have some, but there was no comeback.
Harry lay on his bed and picked up the first sheet of the manuscript with trembling hands. Pages seemed to vibrate with magic, and as he began reading, the magic flowed out of the story and surrounded him. His bedroom vanished in a haze of images and excitement. A brief moment and an eternity later, the story was done. But before the world around him quite settled back into place, Perry knew that more than anything else, he wanted to be a writer.
So this is an incredible video game in the this period of like commercial text adventure development were so far beyond everyone else. You know, they essentially invented the form with Zork. They did so many interesting things, like they were pioneering in like the computer system they created to make these text games was in itself innovative. It was a virtual language, so it existed independent of the computers, so they were able to port them and spread them, and that became something that was very interesting later.
So a bit like Twine today or something like that.
Yeah, like it's I think even more clever in that it's like essentially its own like pretend computer running. So you write code for this pretend computer. They came from like MIT, right? They were all computer people from MIT, so they were very smart.
And so what do you do in a Mind Forever Voyaging for those who haven't heard of it?
So this is a game that at the time was so different and interesting that people didn't necessarily realize either. So like this, it's not like every game was like this back then. So the idea is, in the simplest description, you play the character of a artificial intelligence who's been created by this political scientist, and he is running simulations of a small town in the US to test out the ramifications of a political plan by a guy who's essentially Reagan. The game comes with a novella, and in the novella it's the story of this AI, this character who's growing up through his formative years and reaches adulthood, and then the voice of God comes in and says, "By the way, you're in artificial intelligence. None of this is real." And, you know, Assassin's Creed kind of ripped this off, or maybe they didn't even rip it off, but like used this idea later of like, oh, if we treat the world of the video game as a simulation, it allows us to kind of lampshade certain aspects and kind of play with it. So you are, for most of the game, essentially this AI who has a identity and a life in this small town, Rockville. The beautiful thing about the game, it is not full of puzzles and challenges and all the things that you would have expected at the time. It's essentially an open world city, you know, long before Grand Theft Auto. And you can walk around this simulated small town America. It has a day-night cycle. Things happen. You can go places, go watch a sports game, buy a meal, read a newspaper. And at the start of the game...
This is all relate you via text. There's no graphical representation.
100% text. Everything is described. And, you know, you type, go north, you know, sit at a table, eat food, whatever. Your initial objective is, hey, to test out this plan, here is a list of the 10 things we would like you to do. So it'll say, you know, go to a sports game, buy food, you know, visit a bank. Like it's kind of like here are some representative things that Americans will do in their day-to-day life. And you do these 10 things and tick off the checklist, and you have the ability to record what you're seeing is how this is introduced. So you would, you know, start recording, go and eat a meal at a restaurant, and then you can submit that to your boss and they can analyze the data or whatever. And what happens is when you've done enough of these things, there's enough data for the simulation to then proceed and predict the next 5 years. So you then jump forward 5 years and get to live out a moment in time in the next 5 years. You do this like a few times and the scientist who's your father slash boss slash creator, whatever, says, this is great. Like, we have all the information. Looks like the plan is going to be great for America. I'll give all this to the politicians. Thanks. Just go off and have fun. Like, so immediately on having essentially achieved what appeared to be the purpose of the game, you're told just noodle around and you're given no objective. And what happens is you go back into the simulation and wander around. And then the simulation says, oh, cool, we've unlocked the next 5 years because you've been noodling around. And so you jump to the next 5 years and continue to noodle around. And you start to notice there's a few things that are a little bit iffy going on. And then you continue to populate it and you can push to the next 5 years. And eventually you can push far enough into the future that it becomes very, very bad. And what happens is as a player, you notice that this is happening and give yourself the mission of like, oh shit, someone should know about this. So you start capturing evidence of what you think is bad stuff, right? As this kind of essentially a virtual citizen journalist, and then giving it back to your boss. And at some point, then your boss is like, holy shit, like, this is awful. We need to go show this to people. So on one hand, like the freedom, the idea that without any objective, your curiosity as a player, your ability to observe and be like, oh shit, this is something I need to do without ever being like told, was kind of magical. And then just alongside that, the idea that the key mechanic of this game was witnessing, was just like observing. Like, you know, it wasn't hitting things with a sword. It wasn't all these, you know, very obvious kind of gaming mechanics. It was like, no, the ability to kind of weaponize your gaze and have that be significant was kind of amazing.
It's highly sophisticated, isn't it, really, for the era. This is the mid-1980s that the game's out. This, you know, games have struggled to do that kind of thing ever since, really, haven't they?
Yeah, and it's fascinating because if you look at the record of the time, a lot of people didn't get it. There were a lot of people, especially internally, I think, at Infocom, who were like, this shouldn't be politics in our video games. And found if people criticized it or engaged with it usefully at the time, they would say that perhaps the attack on kind of Reagan-era politics was a bit heavy. But I think in retrospect...
Yeah. And because it's right in the middle of Reagan's... He's going into his second term, isn't he?
Yeah.
When the game comes out around then.
Yeah, so it's right in there. So with the, you know, things are polarized. I saw that someone actually reached out and interviewed Moretzky when the Trump stuff happened. Because they were like, this is literally, so much of this is very specifically predicted in your game. The rise of QAnon, the particular methodologies of Trump, some of the more extreme kind of violence and outcomes of the Trump presidency. These were all the things that at the time people were saying, these are very heavy-handed, right? This is, at the time, because there was this internal debate in Infocom about, like, should we be putting something out that's this polarizing and this political and this ambitious, you know, in an artistic sense, Moretzky had it in his head that, like, this could really cause waves. Like, hey, am I going to be hauled up before the Senate to, like, answer for this political video game? And the disappointing outcome was that people just didn't notice, pay enough attention for it to get that recognition. It just kind of, people that got it. But, you know, in retrospect, it's a fascinating predictor of so much of what's come since in terms of open world games, in terms of, you know, city simulating, but also just has such a different agenda and ambition for video games than what we would think of as the mainstream now.
You're playing this game when you're still quite young. How much of that satirical texture are you noticing at this point in your life?
So I think I probably only appreciated A Mind Forever Voyaging slightly later. So there was this incredible thing that I think it was Activision bought out the entire Infocom catalog at some point. And in the late 90s, they basically put all of the games into a box on discs and reissued them, which was mind-blowing because when I was on my Amstrad CPC, like, the Infocom games were the most expensive premium things Like they were very expensive. They came in these very luxurious pieces of packaging. I probably only had access to one or two of them. Yeah, so the Infocom stuff, again, like I lived a lot of it through the magazine pages reading about it. And so when this collection came out, I was, I guess, on my way to like university. So I was a bit older and more sophisticated. Then it was this treasure trove of these games. And so definitely like in revisiting all of them, playing them all, you know, A Mind Forever Voyaging was at that point the one that absolutely stood out as being like ahead of its time. And my favorite.
And your second choice is also from around a similar time, the mid-80s.
Yes, Mind Wheel.
You lie face up on a table in a Stark laboratory. There is a hospital smell, and dozens of electrodes are attached to your body. Suspended in front of you is a computer keyboard.
This is such a fascinating little offshoot of gaming history. So I'm going to blank on the name of the company that created this now, but...
Is this Synapse software?
Yes, Synapse, there you go. This company was set up with the goal of everything we do, we will bring in a real-world author, and we are going to beat Infocom. Like, we are going to create the next generation of interactive fiction. So Mind Wheel is, it's the best thing they did, I think. It's the most successful of their games. And it's absolutely fascinating because it was written by Robert Pinsky, who would then go on to become an extremely acclaimed poet. I think at the time he was then a poet, but less acclaimed. So the idea of Mind Wheel is you're going inside the minds of some notable people. So there's, I think the game opens and you're inside a rock star. And there's also like the Generalissimo. There's like a kind of fascist dictator. There's all these different key minds, and you're going inside like these strange dreamlike worlds that they've created. And it's coming from someone who, you know, is his day job is being a poet. Like obviously the language and the visuals are extremely evocative. And it reasonably fearlessly, like again, similar to some extent what A Mind Forever Voyaging was doing, doesn't have some of the baggage of what a game should be. And it's very strange game to play now because the Synapse interface is, it's a little bit like, slightly like talking to these AI chatbots now, in that whereas, you know, all of these games you would type in sentences to tell the game what to do, right? So you could say, pick up the bottle from the table, or pour the water into the bottle, ask Bob about his day or whatever. And then with the Infocom one, it was very sophisticated and it was very specific. So if it didn't understand, it would tell you why it didn't understand and you would have to rephrase. The Synapse model was a little bit fuzzier. To make it feel more like you're having a natural conversation, it would be less robotic about things, which allowed you to sometimes type things that you're like, wow, I can't believe the computer understood this. Like, very similar. I think the experience of playing this game back then is probably very similar to now talking to a chat, these kind of AI chatbots and being impressed. But sometimes it would misunderstand you or would make some strange leaps. And the other thing that Synapse did was that the whole thing is running in real time. So the convention for most of these text games is that you take turns. The game will print some text out, you'll read it, you then have as long as you want to type your reply. So it, you know, it like reading a piece of linear fiction, the sense of real-time progression is kind of in your head.
Yeah, you set the pace.
Yeah, with Synapse's games, the game was constantly running. So there would be action sequences in which the thing is chasing you, or, you know, the room is filling up with water or whatever, and you have to act within the time frame. So the weird thing is back then, you know, you're asking about A Mind Forever Voyaging, like this is all rendered just in text. But at that time, actually text was maybe the closest we were to virtual reality in terms of the detail and how the simulation could feel alive, you know, whereas the real-time graphics were just so primitive that you weren't going to get that same feel. So there was definitely, there was a real sense of like, of magic to these Synapse games. Again, like to go back to it now and play it, it doesn't feel dated because of it. You know, it's very unique artistic voice. You know, trying to be in some case is like at the forefront of like, what are we trying to do with interactive narrative? And then you go back and sometimes it can be very humbling to go back and be like, oh shit, like this was 35 years ago and
yeah.
Oh, they were doing this thing. Like, oh man.
But it should be said, Robert Pinsky did go on to become the US Poet Laureate, didn't he? So
yeah.
Not all text adventures are being written by writers of the
No. Like I said, but at this period, it's fascinating because they were bringing pretty notable authors. Douglas Adams was working with Infocom on his Hitchhiker game, and he did this other game, Bureaucracy. A lot of these authors were really, really into the idea. You know, it wasn't like Jerry Bruckheimer being like, I'm going to make video games because the revenue's there. Like, you know, some, a lot of these people, the way in which like home computing was this hobbyist thing, like it was definitely somewhat geeky. So, you know, if they had this predilection, they kind of had like a level of kind of interest in, and that, you know, we're playing the things and they were playing Infocom games. Like, I think the Douglas Adams thing with Infocom kicked off because he was obsessed with their games and he was like right into them, asking for tips or whatever. So
yeah, no, I think as well, some of the Simon and Schuster and Random House, which is now part of Penguin, they had their own interactive fiction divisions at that time, didn't they? Which sort of legitimizes it, makes it a short hop for a professional author or writer to start working in this medium, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely felt exciting and felt achievable as well, I guess. As much as we think of like early video games as being for children, to get into this expensive hobbyist thing, like actually a lot of the audience skewed older. So I think there was probably a good crossover of like who's reading books and reading a certain type of book and also has this hobby. And, you know, there is kind of a nice crossover.
So your third choice, when you first sent you through, I was like, oh, I know this game. And then you sent the follow-up email saying, I actually mean the version from 1986. So can you tell us about that?
Yes. So this is always a good cheat if you're doing video game trivia to try and mess people up in the way I did with you. It was either Activision or Electronic Arts. I'm going to say Electronic Arts. Could be wrong. This was like their big swing at the bookware, at the interactive literature, electronic literature, whatever they were calling it. And yeah, it's called Portal. It has nothing to do with the more successful, popular Valve game.
This morning, I spliced into Med-10 for routine diagnostic augmentation. We had a new viral disease here in Christchurch, something we hadn't seen in almost 20 years. It was nothing serious. A few sheep were showing signs of lethargy. Med-10 led me through the usual series. As we examined the viral DNA together, suddenly the mind link went crazy. It hit my hippocampus pretty hard because I started confabulating. A glowing tunnel, lights in the sky, a boy hunched over a console, walking through a meadow wet with dew. A series of random but intensely real images that took over awareness. Then, nothing.
So the beautiful idea, I love the setup of this game. Where do you buy the game and you read the manual? And the idea is, if I get this right, you're an astronaut returning to Earth. You've been away doing astronaut stuff. And you get to Earth and every single human being has gone, disappeared. And there is this central computer, I believe called Homer, I could be wrong, that was essentially running the world. Like all of the networked computer systems that were running everything around the world is run by this AI. And you go to the terminal to ask him, like, what happened to all the humans? And in the manual, it says, because of certain failures or because these things are not being maintained, the voice and blah, blah, blah interface has been powered down. You'll have to use an old-fashioned manual keyboard interface, whatever. So there's like some kind of lampshading of you're interacting with this super high-tech futuristic AI through your home computer. And the whole game, if you were to be kind of reductive, it's essentially a big hypertext thing. Essentially, you have this computer interface desktop, and it has a bunch of icons, and it allows you to... There's like a news icon maybe and an archive icon and a health icon. So if you guys like the health icon, you can retrieve reports. And this computer was like tracking everybody's vitals, you know, like the little Apple Health was all being tracked through this guy. And then you can go and read, you know, archived news articles and stuff to do with the military. And when you come online and start the game, the AI says to you, like, you know, my systems have been damaged and I can only access a very small percentage of my records. But like, if you go in and start accessing records and pulling them up, like, I will be able to restore some integrity. So it has a similar exploratory kind of pitch as A Mind Forever Voyaging. It is non-linear. So you're pulling up these records in a kind of non-linear way. It has the sense of like rooting around in a file system to discover secrets. So it's essentially the biggest murder mystery ever. Like, who killed every single human being on the planet? Like, I discovered it when I was making Her Story in 2014. I had this idea that was built around interrogating a computer interface and computer database. And it felt mostly something that had occurred to me, you know, somewhat uniquely. But I knew that, like, as a kid, I had played games. There was a Frederick Forsyth game called The Fourth Protocol, which was an adaptation of one of his books, which took place in a kind of similar iconic interface. There were like a bunch of games that I'd played. In developing Her Story, I went back to those, like, oh, let me go remind myself like what these things were doing. As Perellia, I don't think I'd played any of those games. I think I'd seen the screenshots and read about them and found the whole idea fascinating. In kind of digging around, you know, like, who else has done video games where you're exploring things from a database? Discovered Portal, which, you know, has a certain reputation amongst people that track their history and stuff. But I had never played it or heard of it. And I tracked down a copy of it and played it. And it was really exciting because I loved it. And the good thing was, I loved it and I loved the idea of it. But it was clear to me that definitely there was still an opportunity for me to do something interesting that hadn't been done before. But yeah, I'd love for more people to check out Portal. It's really cool. I played it on a pretty crappy, I guess this would have probably, in my head, I remember playing it on a fairly crappy computer. And it kind of added.
Right, yeah. Added to the appeal.
The appeal of it. Like, there was, when Her Story came out, there was an art gallery in, I think it was Montreal. And like, a lot of people were kind of exhibiting Her Story in their kind of art, you know, art / digital, whatever exhibits. And usually that means they'll put like a screen on the wall and there'll be a little plaque or whatever. But this particular art gallery set dressed their basement to look like a little police detective office and got a, you know, cathode ray monitor and put coffee stains on the table and set up the whole thing. So I didn't quite have that playing Portal, but I do remember playing it on a pretty primitive computer that definitely kind of added to this sense of like this kind of lo-fi interface into this very rich kind of sci-fi story.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I just want to wind the clock back a little bit. You know, you talk about when you were a child and doing pixel art and coming up with game designs, it looked like you were going to become a game designer, I suppose, but that's not what happened. You moved to America to join a dot-com company. Is that right? Was that derailing your plans, or how did that come about?
Like, the short version is that, you know, growing up, my dad, the civil engineer, was like the first person in his family to go to university. Both our families were kind of traditional British working class families. So I had no real awareness that if you wanted a career in the arts, broadly speaking, like, that was a thing you could do. And certainly, like, you know, coming off my dad, it was like, you know, you'll go to university to get a good degree, to get a professional job. Like, that's how things work in the UK. As much as I was like making all these things and really interested in them, like I said, I think my dream job would have been to be a painter. It was never really a thing I had a concrete plan for. And certainly, like, going off to university, the general advice was like, hey, you can keep painting as a hobby. And, you know, at university, I got really into the interactive. There was this kind of rebirth of the interactive fiction scene in the late 90s. And I got really into that. But that was very clear. Like, everyone in that scene knew that nobody was paying money for interactive fiction anymore at that point. So everyone was very much doing it for the art rather than seeing it as a path to be a game designer, right? Like, now people might apply for a job with a Twine game and be like, hey, I want to be a narrative designer. Like, that didn't exist as a route or as an idea back then. So, you know, I think if you had cracked open my brain and been like, hey, what do you want to do? These things might have floated up, but finished university and I had a degree in math ultimately there, and I didn't want to do any of the things that you can do with a degree in math. And so this got this job in America because it sounded exciting to go and move to America. And the guy running the company, it's less funny now, but he was like a very much on the kind of Elon Musk end of the spectrum, extremely wealthy, had lots, people loved interviewing him because he had lots of silly ideas. And at the time, it sounded very, it was like, hey, if I'm going to do a job, I might as well go to America and work for this guy that's building a replica French chateau in the Virginia countryside and wants to put chips inside everyone's head. That kind of sounds interesting. And if you were to draw arrows between all these things, like, the principal business of that company was business intelligence and databases. And at the time, they were the only company that could run logic on, I'm going to say, terabyte databases, which is also, I have one sat on my desk now. But back then, that was a big thing. And so all the big supermarkets and banks and stuff would want to use this software. And it was 100% anticipating everything that would go wrong with big data and how our world has changed. But slightly being pitched as this kind of utopian tech thing. So, you know, a year, I was there for like a year. And then some interesting things happened with their financials. They had this thing called the boot camp, where everybody that was employed by the company had to spend 6 weeks learning their software and creating products with it. And then, so, like, you know, whatever, you know, even if you're a top exec or if you're working, you know, if you're a receptionist or whatever, then they wanted everybody to, like, drink the Kool-Aid. One of the things you got to do on this boot camp towards the end was they gave you a data set from someone like Walmart. It was like, here is X gigabytes of Walmart data. And using the software to do like the basket analysis stuff on that. That was very exciting to me because it was very much finding a story, writing, like making a story out of these little, you know, it's very much found art. And, you know, it was all the stuff of like, oh, we've shown that there is, you know, people that buy nappies have a strong cross-buy with like buying beer, right? Because like, first-time fathers will be sent out to buy nappies, so they'll buy themselves a case of beer. Their favorite story was they realized for Victoria's Secret that they weren't selling any black bras on the West Coast because everyone was wearing white t-shirts and it was hot. And this was like an obvious thing that no one had ever realized or thought about until the data showed it them. But I remember just being really excited about exploring like this data of these individuals and what they were buying, and clearly, having ended up making a series of what you could describe as like database stories, you know, you could make a connection there, or it was just, you know, it was something that was there already. But
and then at some point you come back to the UK, that sort of blows up, I suppose, and you move back and you get into the video game industry. And is it around this time that you make the fourth game on your list?
If you look back, it would probably be quite easy to make it sound all very intentional. But Isle was a game I made in university. There was this spark of this renewed interest in interactive fiction in the late 90s. And it was a group of people who met over the internet. Most of us, I think, were in university. If you're at university, you had a computer lab and you had access to unlimited time on the internet. There was a couple of like discussion groups, like Rec Arts Int Fiction and Rec Games Int Fiction, I think. It shows the polarity there. But and it was this incredible group of people who had a nostalgia for these classic Infocom games and classic text games. And we had access to tools that allowed us to make our own. There's a couple of things. There's a guy, Graham Nelson, who first replicated Infocom's virtual machine and then created his own iteration of it that was a free tool. So you could go off and make your own text games. And what a lot of these people did was not just attempt to replicate the experiences of the Infocom games, but attempt to take them further. And so there was an annual competition, which is where a lot of the more interesting or experimental games would get released. And it was a very fun, competitive environment of everybody trying to kind of one-up each other on like how ambitious or clever or interesting their projects were. And Isle was my attempt to kind of contribute to that.
Late Thursday night. You've had a hard day and the last thing you need is this. Shopping. Luckily, the place is pretty empty and you're progressing rapidly. On to the next aisle. Interesting. Fresh gnocchi. You haven't had any of that since Rome. There is a brunette woman a few meters ahead filling her trolley with sauces.
The premise of Isle, it's ostensibly a piece of interactive fiction or a text adventure, and it opens in the pasta aisle of a supermarket, and your character has like some reminiscence about gnocchi, I think, in particular, and then you can type anything. You can type a lot more things than you normally would be able to type in these kinds of games. The game has 130-something endings, I think, but the way that's achieved, and the trick, is that the game lasts a single turn.
Okay.
So you type something, the game will then, off of that, will riff on what you've said and kind of tell you a mini story.
Okay, right.
And then it will reset. And so it exists in a kind of literary multiverse in that, in telling the character to do things, you can create different characters, right? There is someone in there who is remembering this holiday to Rome where he ate gnocchi, and he's sad about it because on that holiday, his girlfriend died. And in typing things and discovering elements of this story, it can then prompt further things. And so this kind of anticipates her story to some extent in that the name of this girlfriend does not appear in the opening text. But the more violent things your character does, the more violent the story you'll get usually. And so in doing one of these violent things, he might have a sudden horrendous flashback to seeing the character Claire die. So now you're like, oh, I have this character name that exists in my head,
right,
that is not in this opening text. So then you can type remember Claire and unlock more things. So there's this, it's not just kind of random access, like there is some usefulness and
sort of meta story.
Yeah, and the neat thing about it, which somebody else wrote a very good piece dissertation on it, and I read it and was like, yes, that sounds very clever, that's definitely what I was doing. There is an arc to it where as you play, like trying to get a happy version of this story, because a lot of the stories are sad. And the discovery that the happier endings come about through attempting to make human contact, and there's this kind of arc and message to the game that gets you there. The genesis for this game was, as somebody that loved A Mind Forever Voyaging and these other experiments, being in this scene where people were doing incredible things. So Andrew Plotkin did this game called So Far, which people were comparing with like Bergman, like in its way, is allegorical fantasy. You know, Adam Cadre did this game Photopia, which everyone kind of loved.
Yep.
There were all these really interesting things where people were attempting to tell different types of story and be very serious and explore very specific emotions. But because we still had this connection back to the classic games and the kind of nostalgia for them, and as well the limits of the medium, as a player, you would often still just kind of fuck about. So you see this in games now, but like upon launching a fresh piece of interactive fiction, one of the things you'll instinctively do is attempt to kind of test the limits of the simulation, see how well implemented everything is. And oftentimes the tradition in text adventures was typing dumb things should get you a clever answer, right?
Like,
so if you would attempt to kiss a character that you should not be kissing, or often there were like violent or silly actions. So, you know, if you attempt to kiss an inanimate object, it would have something funny to say about that. If you would usually the default response, if you try and hit something or smash something, you would say violence is not the answer, right? But you might get more and more specific versions. So a thing you would often do on launching one of these games is kind of mess around in a way that was often at odds with the seriousness of the fiction. And it annoyed me that authors were having to write snarky, funny responses to silly things within the text of their more serious work. It doubly annoyed me that as a player, I would attempt to would type these silly things in. So the genesis of Isle was, I'm going to make a game where if you type that dumb stuff, the game runs with it, right? So if you say kill character, expecting a snarky, funny response, well, let's get the story where this person actually attempts to kill the random stranger in the pastor aisle, right? Like if you're attempting to kiss a stranger, that stops being funny at the point where it actually gets enacted.
Right.
So that was like and part of that genesis was like, oh, if I'm doing this thing that is, you know, aggressively pushing back against this mode, what's the most boring thing? What's the most boring location? Like, we're not going to be in an elvish castle. We're not going to be on a space station. We'll be in a supermarket aisle.
Amazing.
That will be the jumping off point for this thing. And I think like that as the starting point, but then as I developed it and as people playtested it, half the stories and endings in the game came in response to me sending it to playtesters and then them typing things and me being like, oh, I didn't think to type that, right? So I think this kind of arc of unlocking the happier endings and the more human endings came about through, you know, the playtesters pushing that and through me spending more time in myself wanting to get away from just like, you know, the one note idea of you'll time violent things and you'll get like a sad violent story back.
Did I think you said 140 odd stories that you wrote, were any sort of never found by players?
I don't think so. Like, I think players are pretty damn good
at
enumerating. I know that, like, this, I lost the source code a long time ago, so I can't do anything with it, but I have like a couple of requests from players for things that weren't, and it was like pretty methodical in terms of like, here is every single object that exists in this scene. Here are everything you could possibly ask to do to these things. And then let's make sure the parser understands that. But interestingly, I don't know what this says about humans. The actions that I had not implemented that I got the most requests for involved hair. And this is maybe partly due to language. So there's a character, there's a brunette, I believe, further down the aisle. And so I guess by identifying her with her hair color, we're already kind of surfacing the hair. But there's a lot of people who are like, I wanted to pull her hair.
Sniff hair.
You might be able to smell her hair in the game. But there were definitely a couple of actions involving her hair.
Right.
That were not supported by the game, which, you know, I will never get to add anyway. But, you know, so I made Isle. It was like it's something of a hit. I think I released it outside of the competition. But it, like, some of the more notable people there really liked it and wrote nice reviews. And then, you know, then I left university, went off and got this job. And, you know, that was this cool thing I'd put out there onto the internet. You know, then jump forward to the point where I had slightly accidentally got a job in the games industry.
So it was a friend invited you, is that right?
Yeah, I'd come back from America and I had two jobs out there working for .com. people, and the whole .com thing was collapsing. It was kind of hard to get a job because I was no longer a fresh graduate, but my experience on paper was working for .com companies. Most of the jobs that were available, you know, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I had a friend who worked at a video game company, and he knew that I was an artist, so he suggested I get a job as a video game artist. So I kind of knocked together a portfolio, downloaded some cracked versions of the various 3D packages, taught myself them, knocked out a bunch of like 3D characters and did some level design and concept art and just put this horrendous package together, which I think has no longer exists on the internet. Like it predates you know, the mass archiving of the internet, so I'm safe. And that got me a job working on the kind of first-person shooter Serious Sam for the GameCube. And then kind of rapidly I moved up and then moved over to design, became a lead designer,
yeah,
and got a chance to work on the Silent Hill franchise. This is, if we went into this, this would be a whole podcast on its own. And but, you know, the end of that story is that I got to make this game, Silent Hill Shattered Memories, which was the first time I had had the chance to be like, here's my idea for what a video game should look like and how we should tell a story in a third-person video game. And here are some interesting framing devices. And it was really pulling all of the interactive fiction stuff from the late 90s, all of the stuff that was interesting to me there, and trying to put that into a commercial video game.
Yes.
And that was like relatively successful, and we managed to actually execute a lot of it.
Yeah, so hugely well regarded. And you know, to buy that game now on PlayStation 2, you got to, it like it's £200 on eBay or something. So people still want to play it eagerly, don't they?
Yeah, it's that weird thing of, you know, so the Wii version is the version that you should play.
Right.
if you track it down. And but the effort now, you know, so that's, that was a game that came out in 2009. And is essentially dead. Like, you know, meaningfully, only the most hardcore collectors are going to go and get themselves a physical Wii console, you know, buy the disc for $300 and play it. And not just the effort to physically play it, but just aesthetically, like, you know, what was cutting edge 3D characters and textured environments in 2009 on a Wii, you know, it has aged. You know, and some, you know, some eras of 3D graphics have aged better than others, but I think, you know, that's like an era where it's, you know, if you squint, you're like, oh, this is kind of nice, but it's it's harder to immerse yourself in the way that you would have been able to in 2009.
Well, right,
if you were to play that today. So it's weird being in this industry where things age that rapidly.
Yeah, it's kind of tragic, isn't it? This brings us, I think, to your last choice, which comes out after you've created Silent Hill Shattered Memories, but before you fully go independent to make Her Story. Can you tell us about your last choice?
Oh, I think this is funny.
Have I got the wrong one?
I think we've done this. I've tricked you again.
Once again. Okay.
I think this is magnificent.
Oh, dear. I'm much too basic.
I did once make a joke about how if you want to name your video game and have a successful video game, then you should steal the name of a piece of forgotten interactive fiction.
Okay, so your choice isn't Amnesia, The Dark Descent. It's Amnesia, a different one.
Yes. So, I mean, okay. I will say Amnesia, Dark Descent is a fascinating video game and, you know, is very much a good pairing with Silent Hill Shattered Memories, because we were both wrestling with, you know, what should a horror video game look like if it isn't Resident Evil? No, so this is another piece, and this is like, this pairs very nicely with A Mind Forever Voyaging and Portal. So Amnesia.
You wake up feeling wonderful, but also in some indefinable way strange. Slowly, as you lie there on the cool bedspread, it dawns on you that you have absolutely no idea where you are. A hotel room, by the look of it, but with the curtains drawn, you don't know in what city or even what country.
I'm aware that whenever I say this guy's name, I'm possibly mispronouncing it because I've only ever read it. But the sci-fi writer Thomas M. Dish, who was a pretty notable sci-fi writer.
Yeah, another literary figure of the 80s, right?
He was brought in to make a video game, and he made this game called Amnesia. Now, in his favor, I think at this point, amnesia plots were not as overdone in video games. That would be a whole discussion in itself, right, of like, using amnesia as a plot device is very convenient for video games because you kind of put everyone on a you know, an even footing.
Sure.
But this is, on some levels, it's so ambitious the premise of the game, you wake up with amnesia in a hotel in New York. That's like all you're given. And very quickly, you realize there is a scary man from Texas who is insisting that you should be marrying his daughter. And there is like one of the early bad endings you can get in the game is a kind of shotgun wedding scenario. But it unfolds, I think there's quite an elaborate story to do with conspiracies and pharmaceutical companies. But the premise of this game, it goes much further beyond A Mind Forever Voyaging, is the entirety of New York is simulated in this game. And this is coming from an outsider perspective. And obviously Moretzky is with A Mind Forever Voyaging, is coming from the interactive fiction world. But clearly, there is something when you look at the design of these classic video games and the extent to which map making and you know, how do I map out this environment, and everything would be kind of laid out and have connections, whether that was a dungeon in a fantasy game or whatever. And, you know, both of them have clearly looked at the map of a city or a town and been like, oh, this is easily to transpose to a video game experience. The idea with Amnesia is the entire, every single cross street from Manhattan is in this game in text. It's all, you know, it's all text. It has a fully functioning subway system. And this is one of the reasons it's very hard to play now. It has like one of those classic hunger simulators running alongside. So your character has to eat. Your character has to drink. Otherwise they will die. And that's usually the thing that ends up killing you is wandering around us.
You should forget to eat.
Or struggling to figure out like, oh, I don't have any money to buy the hot dog from the hot dog vendor or whatever. But it has a little bit of that synapsey thing of it feeling initially very magical and simulated, because you're like, holy shit, like, I can do anything and go anywhere. Like, I can. and this initial, the initial opening is a pretty nicely simulated of you kind of, I believe you wake up and there's like a knock at the door in the hotel, and it's like room service is bringing you something, and there's the panic of like, oh my God, what am I doing here? Having to get some clothes on or whatever. I believe you can run out naked, like, and the game deals with that. But it's like quite painful to play because of all these restrictions. And ultimately, the simulation of New York is something of a mirage, right? I've attempted a couple of times to play it, and it always ends up being too tedious. But it's got like a whole novel's worth of text in there. I believe this is on my like Amazon wish list. Someone recently put out a book that I think was like half making of and half like the entire design document or script to this game.
Oh, interesting.
It's one of those where it not actually being very good is slightly more inspiring, right? Like to play, you know, as much as like A Mind Forever Voyaging has dated in some ways, like it's still pretty, it's still great. Like it still does all the things.
I think,
you know, to some extent, Portal, if you make peace with the fact that this is not a very dynamic experience, you can still appreciate it. But when you play Amnesia, it is this glimpse at a magic that it's not quite pulling off. And it's exciting because, yeah, if you think, you know, now if somebody brings in a notable name for another medium into video games, it might be a non-awful example would be, you know, bringing George R. R. Martin in to write lore for Elden Ring. It's like harmless, and it's clear how he might bring something to that and kind of embellish things. But the idea that you would bring someone in to actually inject some exciting ambition and to give you a story or an idea for a game that would not otherwise have existed, like, I think that's what's exciting about all this Bookware stuff. You know, to play Amnesia now and to see what it's trying to do, there probably isn't anything that has done it since, right? Like, no one has really created something which has this kind of narrative, the kind of ideas that it's exploring, partly because it's hard.
Yes, right.
And, you know, I think, you know, but all these games, especially Amnesia and Mind Forever Voyaging, have an appreciation of like space as being an integral and geography as an integral part of video games, which I think is the thing we have made good. Right, like if I play Zelda Breath of the Wild or I play Elden Ring or I play Grand Theft Auto 5, the ability to freely walk around a very beautiful or convincing looking space, I think we've clearly done, right? Like, I think if you play the most recent Spider-Man game, you know, that is a pretty good approximation of walking around New York. All of the other stuff that's in Amnesia, which is the kind of the narrative aspects and the human aspects and things, the idea of waking up naked in an unknown hotel room and having to quickly scramble, those are the things that we've struggled to do, right? We can make people
drive
and shoot and run and things. But, you know, when I play these older games, there is that sense of freedom and magic.
And also, I guess, sort of unknown depth to them. So with some of the games you're referring to there, the modern games, you have a map, you can see the boundaries, you can see your to-do list, I suppose, and you have a good sense of when you're coming to the end of it. But with all of these choices, and I think with your own games that you've made, your trilogy of games, they're sort of, you're not quite sure of the shape of it at any time. It goes, you're not sure how deep it goes. And that seems like something that games aren't so good at offering players.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that I find most exciting. The trite response, I think, when Her Story came out, was people saying, why don't you just upload a bunch of clips to YouTube? This isn't a game. But the excitement to me was the idea of that unboundedness of, like, when you start playing Her Story and you don't really know what you're in for and you start discovering clips, every time you discover a clip, it's a surprise. I just love that ability to conjure something up.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us your choices. I suppose when you hand this console over to your friends and family, which is the game that you're going to encourage them to start with?
Interestingly, not to... It would be very arrogant if I was giving this to my friends and family and telling them to play Isle. But I have been told that, like, oftentimes people will use Isle as an intro to, like, classic interactive fiction because it is so straightforward and because it has responds to so many inputs. It's quite a useful little thing. It's probably quite misleading if people were to then go from Isle to then explore the rest of it. Yeah, that's, I don't know, I guess.
I think that's fine. You can pick Isle. Yeah, of course.
You can go with Isle. They're going to be like, what is this console you give us? Why does it have a keyboard attached?
I'm sure it's going to be a multi-million seller, Sam.
Yeah. This is gold. I'm going to unlock all of that cash. Finally, I've figured out how to make money from video games. The text adventure bookware console.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Sam. Yeah, I really appreciate it. And yeah, thanks for sharing some of your story with us as well. I'm sure I could talk to you far more about everything you've done in the years after, in more recent years. But maybe we'll have to get you back on again.
Yeah, sure. It's been fun.
Well, I think that show requires a few post-listen notes. So firstly, thank you so much to my guest, Sam Barlow, the brilliant, lovely, BAFTA-winning Sam Barlow, who is, of course, writer and director, most recently of Immortality, and his company, Half Mermaid, the Brooklyn, New York-based Half Mermaid, were the creators behind Immortality, who are working on new projects now. So... you may have noticed this episode was not quite like the other ones. There are a few reasons for that. Firstly, of course, Sam has picked five bookware games. Wonderful that he chose those games, as you can tell, half of which I didn't know about and hadn't played and misidentified and all sorts of embarrassing things like that. But Sam guided us through what these games are and the appeal that they have held for him and the influence that they've been on him and his work really wonderfully. But of course, there's no music in those games. So the bits that you heard were a little bit of just ambient music that I put behind some vocal readings from a dear friend of mine, Ed Hawkins, who has a rather incredible voice. You may guess that Ed is in fact an opera singer, a bass singer. He has performed with Glyndebourne in the chorus, and then he's been leads with English National Touring Opera and all sorts of other places. I won't listen because I'll probably get them wrong, but you can go to his website, edwardhawkinsbass.com, and you can read about his work. He also has done, you know, audiobooks and readings and things like that, as you can tell from his wonderful voice. So thank you so much to Ed for reading those excerpts from those five games. I hope you enjoyed listening to them, and I think they did. I wasn't quite sure if it was going to work, but I think it does sort of bring the style of each of Sam's choices to life a bit, so we can get a sense of the vibe of those choices. Secondly, this was one of the first episodes I recorded back when I was planning My Perfect Console before it came out, so I hadn't quite got the format totally nailed down. I neglected to go back over Sam's choices. Again, apologies for that. So just as a recap, his five choices were A Mind Forever Voyaging, Portal, no, not that one, Amnesia, no, not that one, Mind Wheel, and Isle. And some of those you can play online in your browser. Not all of them, but some of them are available to play. So search those up and you can see what Sam was talking about in each of those instances. Next problem, I failed to ask Sam for a name for his console, so I emailed him and said, can you tell me what you would like to call your wonderful bookware console? And he wrote, sure, I guess as we're going for, inverted commas, retro console, but for bookware games, close inverted commas, it should be some awful pun there, like, for example, the Playbook. So Sam's console is called the Playbook. There we go. The next problem, which again is down to me. So normally I use the games as sort of scaffolding to ask about the guest life, and I did do that a bit with this episode, but I didn't cover nearly as much ground as I wanted to, and sort of just let Sam talk about what he loves about these games. To be honest, I was super interested in hearing him explaining these games, and I think by the end of that chat I really had a good sense of where his game writing and directing sensibilities have originated, and I hope you have too. So I think, yeah, slightly different episode, a bit less biographical, a bit less anecdote based, but no less listenable, I hope, and enjoyable. So yeah, please forgive my failings there, and celebrate what was good about that. And of course, thank you so much to Sam for just being so generous in taking us through those choices and explaining what he finds appealing about them. Right, if you would like to write to me with any thoughts, with any comments, you can do so at myperfectconsole@gmail.com. If you would like to support the podcast, please do that. Pop along to www.patreon.com/myperfectconsole, and there you can become a supporter and you'll get all sorts of benefits for that. Become part of the community around the game. You get your episodes early and ad-free. You get some bonus content, and you also get voting rights. You get heads up of the four or five guests that are coming up each month, long before they're announced to the general public. Loads of stuff like that. Anyway, you can go to patreon.com/myperfectconsole and read up on that. Right, yes, you'll follow along the podcast on twitter.com/myperfectconsole with the O's removed from console. I haven't set up accounts on Threads or Blue Sky or any of the other social networks that are popping up every day at the moment. Forgive me for that. I think there's enough of a social media presence for you to find out what's going on with the podcast and to engage, and so anyway, I'm quite just exhausted even thinking about that. Right, well, I'll be back again next week with another guest with their five games and with one more perfect console. See you then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.